Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Maisie Card, author of These Ghosts Are Family, published by Simon & Schuster in 2020.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktail, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a really fun idea. Today, we're drinking an Under the Mango Tree inspired by Maisie's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Maisie's work, Maisie Card is a writer based in Newark, New Jersey. Her debut novel, These Ghosts Are Family, won the 2021 OCM Bocas Prize for Fiction and was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. Among other venues, her writing has appeared in the Paris Review Daily, the New York Times, Guernica, and other publications. She is currently an instructor for the Sackett Street Writers Workshop and a fiction editor for the Brooklyn Rail. A starred Publishers Weekly review says of Card's novel, These Ghosts Are Family, through a fluid blend of patois and erudite descriptions of Jamaica, Card offers a kaleidoscopic portrait of a troubled but resilient family whose struggles are inscribed by the island they once called home. This masterful chronicle haunts like the work of Marlon James and hits just as hard.
These Ghosts Are Family revolves around the consequences of one man, Abel Paisley's, and tells the story of the Paisley family from colonial Jamaica to present-day Harlem. There is Vera, whose widowhood forced her into the role of a single mother. There are two daughters and a granddaughter who have never known they are related. And there are others, like the houseboy who loved Vera, whose lives might have taken different courses if not for Abel Paisley's actions. These Ghosts Are Family looks at the ways characters wrestle with the ghost and try to create independent identities out of the family and their trauma. The result is a book that is an engrossing portrait of a family caught in the sweep of history, slavery, migration, and the more personal dramas of infidelity, lost love, and regret. We're so pleased to talk with Maisie Card about her book today.
How are you feeling today, Maisie?
I'm feeling good. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, today we're looking forward to talking with you about your work and also having you give a reading for us a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
Yeah, I'm getting used to it. I was very nervous in but yeah, I'm pretty used to them now.
I understand that some of the chapters of this book were published as short stories. Can you share with us the ones that were and what kind of revision you did so that they cohered so well within the novel?
Sure. The first chapter I actually published as a short story was called Estelle's Black Eye. Yeah, and I was as an MFA student at the Brooklyn College writing program when I wrote that one, and wasn't able to publish it until maybe 4 or 5 years after graduation. But yeah, it was when I wrote it, it was intended to be kind of a standalone story. So I had to really think about the connections and kind of blend Estelle into the family. And also the story Gratitude was published in the Sycamore Review separately. And I think that was one of the first stories I wrote when I was in the MFA program. And it was sort of inspired by my memories of attending my grandmother's funeral when I was a kid in Jamaica. And maybe that one had the least, I want to say it had the least revision. It still had a lot of edit after the book was bought, but I didn't really have to, I think, work as hard to make more connections between the characters because it was always about him and Vera. Vera being the main character.
Interesting.
But Past Lives was published by the Liars League, which is a kind of journal where they hire actors to do a live reading at KGB Bar of fiction. And that one originally did not have this kind of Irene character. Like she was somebody, a lot of the stories had kind of different characters. But then at some point, I just kind of decided to make them all part of the same family because they were inspired by my family in some way. And so I had to change the timeline and change the relationships a bit to make it fit.
Yeah, that definitely. There's a lot of characters in this book. And it's so funny you mentioned Vera as a main character because I definitely felt that to be the case. So I was kind of surprised that the book jacket talks a lot about the men. I feel like the women are so important in this book. How did you feel about the balance of men and women going on while you were doing the writing?
Yeah, I think I intended at first Abel to be more central when I started writing it. But then as I went through it, I realized that it wasn't so much about Abel, but rather the consequences of what Abel did. And so that's when kind of the women took over more. But yeah, I think I did want to write from the perspective of men as well, and especially men of different social classes too, and women of different social classes. So yeah, those were characters that just kind of popped up in the course of writing, like the Vincent character. He was originally just in gratitude. And then later, as I wrote, I realized that I wanted to give him his own story and get his perspective on what happened.
So I'm really interested, too, in the settings of Jamaica and New York City in this book. What I know you have some personal history with Jamaica. What were the joys or challenges about writing about either or both?
Well, in this book, it's Jamaica and it's primarily set in New York. I think Jamaica is always a challenge because I didn't grow up there. I just remember it from memory and from the visits that I had when I was younger, which was very few and far between until I got to college. And then I started going more regularly. So I did kind of struggle with questions of authenticity and worry a lot about getting things right. So I ended up doing kind of a lot of research. Every time I try to mention a road or a street, I had to pulled up a map to make sure that it exists. And there are a lot of different versions of each chapter of this, but some were more relying on real places. And I think as I edited it, I realized that it didn't matter as much. But for a long time, I became really preoccupied with doing a lot of research. And it took me 12 years to write. And part of that, I think, was because I got bogged down by the research process because I was so concerned about getting Jamaica wrong. Yeah. And New York City, I grew up in New York, so that wasn't as much of a challenge for me. But even still, it's funny to notice the kind of errors that copy editors pick up on that I didn't pick up on with like subway lines and different things, even though I grew up here.
Yeah.
But New York wasn't as challenging as Jamaica, but the time period, because we're jumping back and forth in time, sometimes I did have to check if this place was present in, 2007 and just different small details.
Yeah. You're talking about research and it seems like you did so much research. It does not hurt that you're a librarian, I think. Like some of the things that I read that you looked into, of course, your own family history, you did DNA ancestry testing, you found Thomas Thistlewood's papers. I'm curious, you just talked about some of the location research. What other key pieces or things did you discover in your research that you pulled into this book?
The second chapter of the book is called The Lamb or the Lion. And it's kind of this backstory on the first few years of Abel and Vera's relationship as told over the course of, I think, a day. And the day is significant because it's when Haile Selassie, who is the emperor of Ethiopia and who the Rastafarian community in Jamaica thought of as a kind of god or a messiah figure, was coming on his visit to Jamaica. So I decided like years ago to set it during that time period. And so I spent a lot of time kind of just researching Rastafarianism. And I wanted to kind of look at it from a different angle than maybe like the American mainstream kind of sees Rastafarianism. I think growing up here, the way it's presented in American culture, it's kind of representative of all Jamaican culture. And I wanted to kind of show that, no, it had this very long history of violent persecution at the hands of the Jamaican government to kind of be seen as a legitimate religion. And this day when Haile Selassie came was really significant for them. So I ended up doing like way more research, I think, than I needed to.
But it's so interesting. I mean, when I was reading that part, I wanted to stop reading the book and go do research on it myself because it's something I don't know a lot about. And it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, there was a lot I didn't know about what they went through. And it's relevant because there's still kind of some of that persecution going on in the modern day. Mm-hmm. And then Thomas Thistlewood reading his diaries. I really learned how we imagine slavery as violent, but I think we don't necessarily talk about how violent, and we don't talk about the level of sexual assault and exploitation that women slaves specifically had to endure. So it was really it was really shocking because that Thomas Thistlewood was a plantation owner who he actually kept a log or a diary over the course, I think, of almost 30 years of every kind of violent thing he did in Jamaica, specifically in regards to women and his slaves. And so that was shocking. And that was probably the most difficult part to incorporate into the book.
Yeah. I went and looked at that. I looked at those documents after I was reading that part. It is pretty awful.
So this was 12 years of writing you mentioned. My curiosity when I think about someone working on a work for 12 years is, what other forms had you written in before this, during this? Were you doing other things intermittently to working on these chapters? And do you write in multiple genres?
Before I started writing this book, I actually was working on personal essays a long, long time ago. And one of the essays I found kind of informed or inspired this book. So yeah, every once in a while, I'll go back to writing essays. Other genres, I was working on a screenplay actually for a while, which I eventually just kind of abandoned because it was so hard. But it was actually based on the chapter Estelle's Black Eye. And my friend and I were trying to develop it into a full length, you know, kind of feature. But yeah, primarily I would say like fiction. I think when you do a lot of MFA programs, a lot of the workshops are kind of centered around short stories. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's kind of why this novel kind of sprung out of those short stories that I wrote when I was in the program. And I kind of adopted this novel and stories kind of format for it.
Yeah.
I have a question about the voices in the story. There are so many voices in the story, living and dead. And as I was reading it, I kept thinking about how challenging it would be to manage them all or to wrangle them all. When you were drafting the novel, how did you keep track of all the characters, all the times, the places? You're doing a lot of movement and you've got different voices. I was wondering, like, did you have something that you did specifically in the process of drafting to help you with that?
No, I was pretty unruly in the beginning. I think, you know, I didn't really know if it would be published. So, and also I wasn't writing consistently over 12 years. I would just put it away and come back to it. I would approach it basically like a story at a time, because even when I realized that it was evolving into either an interconnected story collection or possibly a novel, mm-hmm. I still wanted everything to be self-contained, each chapter to be self-contained. So that just kind of made it easier to look at everything kind of in isolation at times. Mm-hmm. But yeah, keeping track was towards the end, once I actually got an agent and we were working together on, she was giving me her feedback on how to possibly finish it. That's when I kind of had to go back and look at what I did and kind of look at all the characters and the inconsistencies that were there. My agent actually was the one who suggested that I make a family tree. Mm. And once I did that, that became a really great way to organize everyone in the book, have everybody, yeah, like visually in front of me, and then have to figure out all the birthdays and the years to make sure they match. And kind of just even to know their kind of lineage, even for the characters who aren't kind of mentioned in the novel, to have that timeline and to have that history kind of helped me just make more formal connections between everybody and made everybody feel a bit more real.
Yeah.
So you had this agent before you even finished the book. So she had looked at a piece of it and then wanted to help you develop it to finish it. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, my path to getting an agent was a bit non-conventional. It actually came from one of the few personal essays that I had written. I wrote a personal essay for Lenny Letter, and it was just about my family. It was about actually me being an adult and not introducing my boyfriend to my family and kind of thinking through why. And my agent, I guess, was a Lenny Letter subscriber, and she read the essay and she contacted me and she asked if I had any other work. And so I told her I had this book that I'd been working on for a long time, and I gave her this synopsis. And yeah, so she did sign me based on that. And then we kind of developed a timeline on when I would actually finish the whole book.
That's amazing.
Wow. I have one more question about something in the narrative that I was really interested in. So I really was fascinated by the yard boy Bernard character in the book and how he is mortified to have been so erased by Vera. There was just such a really strong undercurrent for me of thinking about how that must feel, that erasure, and then how it connected, of course, to the continuous movement in the book of the plot. How or why, or did you expect to make his narrative so important to the story? What was his narrative doing in your head that caused it to come out about that erasure? I thought that was so great.
I didn't expect for it to be such a long like chapter, or so, as significant as it was. I think when I first started writing that story, it was just me recalling going to my grandmother's funeral. I think I was around 9. And I think it was the first trip we had taken back to Jamaica. And I was just like there watching kind of all the rituals surrounding her death. And I remember one thing that stuck out to me was how afraid everybody was before she was actually buried to go into her room.
Oh.
And I remember we were all sleeping on the floor because the house was very full, and hers was an empty bedroom. But nobody would sleep in there. And then I remember this man that I didn't know was the only one to sleep in there. And then later, I saw he was one of the people who were digging her grave. Now that I think back, there were like helpers. My mother and my father didn't have any kind of help because we were the help, we were poor. But I think, you know, sometimes when I would visit like a cousin, or later when my grandmother became sick, you know, all the aunts and uncles in America, I think, pulled together and hired like a helper to take care of her. Mm-hmm. And it's so strange because I remember going and them, these people kind of just being in the background and sometimes being kind of gossiped about or talked about, even though they were kind of spending more time with my grandmother than we were. Yeah, and I think specifically with the man on the bed who slept on her bed, I remember kind of the adults around me kind of like whispering about it and how like kind of inappropriate it was that he was laying on her bed, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't know who he was, but I just noticed that they were talking about him as if he was like unworthy. And so those kind of just class dynamics kind of stuck with me later on. And I think a part of what I wanted to get across just in general all throughout the book is that there's just like a lot of people who seem invested in presenting Jamaica as this kind of paradise. And I just kind of wanted to show that there are just a number, but despite all the, you know, the shared history, there's a lot of different divisions that sometimes we don't talk about or address.
Yeah. With the many shifts in point of view throughout the novel, I think there's only one time where you write in first person. Can you talk about why you chose to write Karen in first person?
Well, the way it was originally written, actually, when I was in the MFA program, it almost kind of sounded like it was first person, but it sounded like second person. It was Karen talking to her mom directly. Hmm. I think a lot of the feedback that I got was that it sounds like second person. You know, people aren't going to like this. So when I was sent it out to be published and it, you know, kept getting rejected, I thought maybe if it sounds more like Karen's voice, it's more specifically first person, it'll get published. So I changed it and it did. But yeah, I think first person is actually the hardest.
I agree.
For me to write in. I feel like I'm even more comfortable writing in second person than first person. Yeah, but at the same time, I wanted that story to feel very intimate. I wanted it to feel like, especially because of the ending and what happens to Estelle, I think I wanted the reader to get a sense at how tired Karen is mm-hmm. from growing up with her mother. And I think first person felt like the most appropriate point of view.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. And I'm like you, I can write in third and even second better than first, but I love to read first, especially when it's sort of a startling or surprising moment in a narrative where it doesn't exist elsewhere. So I really liked it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I'm curious. I keep thinking in my head about the Bernard story. Sorry, I get stuck there for a minute. Because I really felt a serious sympathy and compassion for him. And I was drawn to that every time. And then not only that, but the idea of how these women who knew Vera were like kind of making her like she was all that. And they were all her supporters at the funeral. But it was the hypocrisy of that society. I thought you did such a good job with too. You know, how they had really kind of tortured her previous to that and weren't even that close to her. So the next question I have is, what's the best part of your publishing journey with These Ghosts Are Family? And what's been the hardest part?
I think just watching the book like come to life, like the cover, I didn't know what to expect. Everything was like, it's so completely new to me, the process. But yeah, I think I had like a very smooth publishing ride. And it was kind of surprising how smooth. But I think also getting the feedback from readers has been really positive, especially Caribbean readers who have responded and said that this kind of makes them think of their own families or think of their own history or kind of realize. I think one woman messaged me on Instagram and told me that her and her grandma were reading it out loud. And I was like really amazed by that. So I guess just the positive feedback has been great. The hardest part, probably the pandemic and having to kind of figure out how to promote a book during the pandemic. And I guess having to still feel like your book is relevant despite everything, you know, that's going on in the world has been a bit rough. And I think also because of the pandemic, it's a plus. I've been doing more events, but it is also kind of exhausting in a different way, I think, than I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. I'm super fascinated about your being a librarian because I love librarians. I have a lot of librarian friends. And I think as an author and a librarian, that's an even more interesting thing. Working in a library as a librarian, seeing people check out what they check out. Did you have an ideal reader you imagined for this book? And do you feel like the responses you're getting from readers are surprising you with who's reading it? Or do you feel like it's right in alignment with what you expected?
No, I think it's very surprising at times. I think I had a couple of maybe my ideal reader, I guess I just thought about people like me, people who maybe were the children of immigrants who were kind of reflecting on their family's journey to America and how it changed them as well. But I think what's surprising is I think a wide range of people are seeing themselves in it, in the book, seeing their own families in the book.
Heather, I know you were really interested in Bernard. I was really most drawn to the three little girls. And even though they were only on the page for a short time in your book, Maisie, for me, they stayed with me long after I finished reading. And I was wondering where these characters came from for you and how did you see them fitting in with the larger narrative of the novel?
They started in the Bernard story in Gratitude. And at first, I think when I was in the MFA program and I wrote them, I was just having fun, like creating all these characters because that story, there are kind of multiple voices in that one story. I enjoyed having all these people reacting to Bernard. And I didn't know that they would carry out into the rest of the novel until I was very close to the end, I would say. I guess I could give it away. I don't know. But, you know, at the end of the story, you know, Bernard ends up taking...
No spoilers. Okay, no spoilers. I'm protecting your reader, Maisie. Okay.
Well, so the girls originate in the Bernard story, but then we don't see them again till the last story in the novel. Oh, that's kind of a spoiler too, isn't it?
That's okay. All right. I'm over it. You say what you'd like.
Yeah. So I didn't really know what I was going to do, that they were going to reappear. But then I sort of just was having fun, like reading about folklore. Mm-hmm. And I'd written a lot about ghosts or, you know, duppies and various like superstitions. But I started reading about this folktale or this legend, the Ol Hag, who's this, in some stories, she's kind of like a witch. And in other stories, and I think it depends on which Caribbean island you're dealing with, she's kind of vampiric. I think in Guyana, like specifically the Ol Hag, like, you know, it's an old lady who lives in the community and comes into your house at night by slipping through keyholes and can suck blood. And then in some of the older stories I had read set in Jamaica, she shapeshifts. She can turn into an owl or she can turn into a cat. I just was so fascinated by that story. I hadn't particularly like heard it when I was growing up. There was just a lot of mention whenever I looked at different Jamaican folklore. I thought of them, the three little girls, taking on this kind of power and kind of acting as allegories for what the women fear and become in the novel. Mm-hmm. And experience. The last story with them is very violent. And I think I wanted to show throughout the book that trauma is a character too, and that trauma kind of shapeshifts in a multitude of ways throughout each chapter or each story in the book. That was kind of the final transformation, what happens to the three little girls. And I think first I wanted to show oral tradition and just the idea that what really lives on more than anything are these like oral stories that get passed down. And I wanted to just try to write my own kind of new folktale. Mm-hmm. Or folklore. But I also kind of just wanted to think about how in other places in the story, the trauma manifests in some kind of supernatural way. I think sometimes when you've experienced trauma, the one thing you fear is kind of becoming a monster yourself. Uh-huh. And passing that trauma down to other people. So I thought about what would happen if I had these little girls transform kind of into monsters, so to speak, and that's how I ended it.
Thank you. I like the idea of trauma shape-shifting is really intriguing to me.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, we're looking forward to hearing you read from an excerpt of These Ghosts Are Family. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called Under the Mango Tree. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make one and enjoy it. Here are the ingredients. It's made with 2 ounces of mango juice or mango orange juice, kind of whatever you have. 1 ounce of dark rum, 1/2 ounce of grenadine, 1/2 ounce of lime juice, and a dash of cinnamon. You put everything in the shaker, add ice, give it a shake, and pour it over more ice in your glass with a garnish with lime. And I am having one now while I listen to Maisie. I'm very excited.
Maisie, anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you're going to share today?
Sure. I'm going to read from the chapter called Atonement, and it is about a character named Debbie who's loosely connected to the family. She's actually a white character who marries the son in the family, Vincent, later on. But in this section, Debbie has inherited her ancestor, Harold Fowler's diary. And Harold Fowler is the character who's kind of based on Thomas Thistlewood. He was like a plantation owner in Jamaica. And so Debbie starts reading it, and she's so affected by it that she kind of struggles to figure out what she can do to atone for her ancestor.
Great. Go ahead.
Reading Harold's diary made Debbie think often about whether evil was passed down.
She used to think that she was a good person. She'd never led a lavish life. Even though she had a seemingly never-ending stream of money from her dad, she only took enough to pay her bills and go out to eat once in a while. She wasn't greedy. She didn't act like someone who came from money. But now she thought about the fact that she never really did anything to make the world better. She did nothing for other people, for humanity. She wasn't evil, but she wasn't particularly good either. She'd started to wonder whether, since Harold had put so much evil in the world, she could afford to be neutral. She had to atone. She had no choice. If there was such a thing as hell, she was certain that Harold had tipped the scale so deeply toward eternal damnation, he must have tainted the souls of his descendants too. She borrowed books from the library on the history of Jamaica. She combed the internet. That was how she discovered that there was a town named after Harold, simply called Harold Town, where the plantation once stood. She looked for other mentions of Harold Town, but she could barely find it anywhere. The little she did find on the internet just mentioned how poor it was. Residents basically existed as subsistence farmers, scrounging whatever they could off the land. She knew that her dad was leaving her money. She hadn't thought about how much, but she figured now that it was probably significant. Maybe she would build a little school or a library. If her dad didn't leave her enough, she could fundraise for donations. Maybe if she offered college scholarships, it would make a difference. There were real steps she can take, concrete actions, to offset some of the evil that Harold had done. On the last day of her internship, she asked Jane for the professor's contact. Debbie decided to fly to Jamaica without telling her father. When she called him, he claimed that he was still doing well, but she worried that he was just trying to protect her. Professor Gregory taught classes on slavery and plantation life, and he said she could audit his class in exchange for allowing him to take a look at the journal. He had a room she could rent, and he promised that on her first weekend in Jamaica, he would drive her to Harold Town. He said he would take her on a tour of the ruins of Harold's plantation himself. On the flight over, Debbie fell asleep. She dreamt that she was on the bank of a river, beating white clothes against a rock. She felt two hands grab her. One clenched her shoulder and one held firmly onto her hair, and then plunged her head forward into the water, smashing her head against a stone on the way down. Her nose and windpipe started to burn as she struggled to hold her breath. Her lungs were on fire. At some point, she passed out, and when she came to, she was spitting out water. She saw Harold's face. She always pictured a broad white face as expansive as the moon, with two inflamed ruddy cheeks, his features dimmed by the wide brim of his hat, his eyes hateful. He lifted up his foot, pulled it back, and just before he kicked her in the face, she woke up screaming. "Are you all right?" the man next to her asked. Two flight attendants came over. "I'm fine, I'm fine. Can I just have some ice water?" she asked, just to make them go away. When their plane landed, there was a smattering of applause. Debbie made it out of the airport and was ambushed by a throng of darting eyes, Jamaican people looking for their loved ones. Most of the white people had gotten off when the plane made a stopover at Montego Bay, so Debbie felt self-conscious. She saw a sign with her last name. The man who held the sign wore a red mesh tank top, denim shorts, and thick-strapped leather sandals. A white visor shaded his eyes but left his slightly thinning hairline exposed to the sun. His face was light and covered with freckles. His buzzed hair had a reddish tinge. "Debbie?" "Yes," she said. "Professor Gregory sent me to pick you up," he said. "I'm Vincent." One of his front teeth was twisted around, giving his smile a childlike quality, which contrasted with his bullish frame. Debbie had never seen a black redhead before. She did not mean to treat him as if he was some medical oddity, but she found herself sneaking glances at him as she got into his white pickup truck. She thought the ride would be uncomfortable, that they would drive in silence, but Vincent wouldn't stop talking. He asked her where she lived, and when she told him Brooklyn, he bombarded her with questions. He asked her about the weather, the stories she liked, the movies, what food she ate. Finally, he asked why she wanted to go to Harold Town. "It's named after my great-great-great-great-grandfather," she said, not wanting to go into too much detail. "Ah, I'm the one who run the plantation," he asked. "Yes, are you from there?" "My father from there. He died when I was born, but when I take Professor Gregory class, he helped me do research. I never get to finish my degree, but we stay in touch. He a good man. I do work for him from time to time. He asked me to drive you to there tomorrow." She wanted to say something. Did Harold own his great-great-grandfather? Did Harold rape his ancestor? Was it sick that she felt attracted to him? She wanted to apologize, but she didn't know how to bring it up. He didn't seem upset or angry with her. He turned on the radio and started singing along to the music, a song about chasing the devil away. "Who's this?" she asked. "Max Romeo," he said, and continued to sing along to the radio the entire way. Professor Gregory was younger than expected. He had dark, smooth skin like Jane's and a direct stare. Once he showed her to her room, he didn't waste any time asking for the journal. He took it back to his room to read immediately, and shortly after, his housekeeper, an older Jamaican woman, fixed Debbie a chicken sandwich. She didn't see him again until Vincent arrived to pick them up the next morning, when he handed the journal back to her. "We need to talk about what you plan on doing with this," he said. "Let's do the tour, and then we can discuss next steps at dinner." It was hot outside in the 90s. The palm fronds seemed to spasm in the wind as they drove along the shoreline, past the seaside factories, billing out clouds of clay-colored smoke. It took them an hour to leave the city and begin the trek into the mountains. When they did, they passed through town after town made up of houses that looked like they'd had been pieced together with scraps. They saw goats wandering around aimlessly with greater frequency than she saw rats on the subway tracks in New York. The higher they climbed, it seemed the narrower the roads became. Whenever they were going around a bend, Vincent had to honk his horn so the drivers coming in the opposite direction knew how to slow down. One of them had to stop and let the other pass, or else they would have smashed into each other and perhaps dived over the side of the road, plunging into the deep valley below. The professor had talked for most of the trip, explaining to Vincent and Debbie that he was writing a book on the sexual exploitation of slaves in Jamaica. He talked about the narratives he'd read so far and the other scholars whose research he'd explored. She wanted to ask him to stop. The thought of the rapes that Harold had committed, along with the bumpiness of the roads, was making her nauseous. But Vincent seemed interested, so she said nothing. Vincent turned on the radio later, cutting the professor off, signaling that he had spoken enough. She met his eyes gratefully in the rearview mirror. After about 4 hours of driving, Debbie fell asleep. She dreamt she was under the river again. This time, she wasn't in pain. She was in the water looking up at the sky, and she realized her body was floating with the current. She was dead, yet it was the most peaceful dream she'd had in weeks. "You can read me a little bit of the book?" Vincent asked when she woke up. "It's very graphic," she said. "Me a big boy, you know," he said, giving her a grin. She flipped to the page she knew she had just dreamt about. The 6th of June, 1823. Katrin gave birth to a boy, Harold Fowler II. Wife and baby in good health, Peta Gay is a beautiful child, nearly 7 and already growing tall, but she is not a son. I will sleep deeply tonight and evermore with knowledge that I have an heir. The 7th of June, 1823. Katrin drowned in the river. Do not know how she got out and walked all the way in her weakened state. Slaves swear, even after flogging, that none of them aided her. Alma has told Peta Gay that her mother died of dengue fever. "Jesus Christ," Vincent said. Debbie didn't want to tell them how she'd been Katrin in her dream, how she'd known that she was happy that she drowned. They'd think she was crazy. They rode in silence for about a half an hour. Finally, Professor Gregory announced that they were approaching Haroldtown. "You can see the river," he spoke of in the journal below. She looked down at the valley, saw a few people wading through a river that looked half dried up. She could see houses with corrugated tin ceilings or brightly painted concrete roofs spread out across the dense green landscape. "You excited?" Vincent asked, looking back at her. She nodded, but seeing the river filled her with dread. In another 30 minutes, they had somehow managed to wind down into the valley. "You in Haroldtown now," Vincent said. She didn't know how she would feel once she set foot in the world of the diary in real life. But as they got out to take a picture in front of the Welcome to Haroldtown sign, she had a strong urge to run. She felt a heavy boulder in the pit of her stomach the deeper they walked into town. She didn't know how much more she could take. Debbie didn't even realize that she still had the journal in her hand. She could ask Vincent to hold it. Maybe that was why she felt so afraid. She could feel its dark energy flowing through her. She saw that Vincent was walking away from them toward the river. He took off his shoes and walked into the water, bending down and splashing his face with water to cool off. "Let's sit by the bank for a minute and talk about where we should go first," Professor Gregory said. He walked toward Vincent. "There are rocks to climb over before you could stand on the bank," and Professor Gregory offered her his hand. She was still a few feet away and felt like her feet were anchored into the dirt like the roots of a tree. Everything inside her said, "Stay away."
Wow, wonderful. Thank you so much. It was so nice to be in that world and hear excerpts from your book today. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
We've got a couple of last quick questions for you. I always like to ask, what advice would you offer to new writers?
One thing I always say, or I've been saying lately, is to kind of, it sounds like a cliche, but I would say like call yourself a writer and take your work seriously. Mm-hmm. I was like very hesitant to do that in the beginning of writing this book, and I think it slowed me down a bit.
I think that's excellent advice.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you one more question. Tell us about what your anticipated next projects are for the next 12 months or the next couple of years. What do you anticipate working on?
The book I'm working on right now is set in Florida. about a group of women working as home health aides in a wealthy kind of retirement community and just kind of about their friendship. And then, yeah, I have some ideas planned in the future. I do want to write another historical book that takes place during slavery in Jamaica. Yeah, and it just some of the characters, and I wanted to focus on women, and one of the characters is Queen Nanny, who's a Jamaican kind of national hero. So I hope to work on that maybe next year.
Those all sound wonderful. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us at Book Tales today. We really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read from your work.
I really enjoy talking to you too. Thank you so much.
Yes. And everybody, please order Maisie's book, These Ghosts Are Family. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.